Chapter 17. Hollis. Hollis Johns listened. He stood in the doorframe of his study, motionless, except perhaps for a gentle and warm sloshing between his ears. He listened to his house, closed his eyes, listened. It breathed, he thought, like a person. Respiration. And that was not all. There was also circulation through a tangle of pipes that surrounded him, buried within the walls, and an electrically based nervous system, all within an aging skeleton, wrapped in an increasingly weathered epidermis. It listened. It spoke. It knew things. It had memory. "We are alone now," the house told him. And that suited Hollis just fine. He opened his eyes and glanced over his shoulder, back into the dark study, at the digital clock on the corner of the desk. The red figures glowed back at him like thin, sloppily arranged embers that ebbed and waved in the distance. Three numbers. The first was bony and straight and emaciated. Obviously a one. The other two numbers were a blurry mystery. A three? A five? He squinted at them for a moment, and then tried to look at them through his wine glass, as though its empty curvature might bend the light, focusing the world through a film of Chablis, like a lens. But this did not help. That he was wearing a watch never occurred to him. No matter. It was one something. Late. Everyone was in bed. Hollis pushed off from the doorframe and wandered up the hall toward the stairs. He noticed light spilling from the laundry room and continued past the stairs to the end of the hall. Freshly washed shirts, his shirts mostly, were hanging from the dowel. He raked his fingers along the empty sleeves. They were dry and had already been ironed. Briefs and towels and socks had been neatly folded and arranged in decorous stacks on the dryer. The basket was gone, which meant that Susan had taken a load up before bed. A good woman, Susan. Bless her heart. A lot to love there. A lot to love. With his left hand, Hollis clutched at the large stack of underwear. He used two fingers of his right hand to collect a bouquet of socks, carefully arranging them to encase the stem of his wine glass, until it looked as though he had plucked from some darkened corner of the basement an exotic polyester mushroom with an inverted crystal head. Hands full, he employed his elbow to turn out the light. When three attempts failed to actually connect elbow with anything but wall and doorframe, he repeatedly mashed the light switch with underwear until the room went dark. Hollis started back toward the stairwell, his way much darker now. He was again deterred, this time by the door to the storage room, kitty corner from the laundry, which had been left slightly ajar. He thought this a bit odd, since the room was almost never used. He pushed the door open and mashed the light switch with his underwear. The light was old and yellow, and the boiler hissed and clicked at him from its concrete pedestal in the corner, as if in greeting. The junk room, the kids called it, a telling misnomer, indicative of a generational decay in values. It was not a junk room. It was a... what? It was a vault. It was a place of storage for things worth storing. The younger set, his children's generation, consumed the world like ravenous beasts, oblivious to value, disgorging everything almost instantly into piles of trash. It was their micro-attention span and their technological preoccupation, their defenselessness to advertising and hucksterism, and their overactive sense of entitlement to the latest and greatest. Consume, consume, consume. Excrete, excrete, excrete. It was worse than simply an automatic preference for the new over the old, which in itself was bad enough. Nowadays, anything not still sealed in its original wrapper was utterly without value. Junk. Artificial obsolescence had settled in as the new organizing principle of the predominant culture. The world had been handed to a generation with a compulsion for mindless reinvention, an addiction to upgrading, and a pathological aversion to investment. Investment of anything, in anything. If it requires patience to develop, if it takes time to fully appreciate, if it has so much value as to withstand the moment, then nobody wants anything to do with it. It is, in a word, junk. Although, and here he thought of her again, there were exceptions, weren't there? There were counterexamples, individuals under 30 who recognized value when they saw it. Individuals whose instincts were to gather wisdom and to deepen themselves at every opportunity. Individuals who soaked up life and learned through a kind of osmosis. Hollis scanned the overburdened shelving from left to right, high to low, as though he were reading a very large book. The shelving itself changed rather dramatically, two-thirds down the wall, from old, warped, and knotted pine, splintering along some of the edges, to a darker, glossy oak that he had installed after ripping out a surreptitiously leaky sink and rotting cabinetry 15 years earlier. That moldering furniture had gone down in marital history as one of Susan's indisputable victories, marking one of his rare concessions, that there really had been a smell coming from somewhere in the house, that it really had not been her imagination, that she really was not making something out of nothing, that he really should not have been so dismissive of her concern. He may not have actually apologized, but he had clearly conceded the point, which, after all, was just as good. Just to give Susan her due, he had ripped out the lime green cabinets, removed the plumbing, repaired the wall and flooring, and installed the shelving all by himself. Each hour of the renovation, the project had taken a week and a half of toiling after work, after dinner, down in the basement with a bottle of wine and a crowbar, had been a reminder that Susan had been right all along. Fair is fair. And the truth was, there really was more storage now. No question about it. She had been right. Hollis missed the old room and the lime green cabinets just the same. Inexplicably, recalling the old room conjured thoughts of Tilly. She momentarily dampened the buzzing in his head and the fuzzy pleasantness of the past 2 days. It was not uncommon for thoughts of Tilly to have a disquieting effect on Hollis, and, for this reason, he generally tried not to think of her. Of course, those were almost always thoughts of his adult daughter, the one with her condescension and disdain and her combative alliance with Susan, the daughter who had found a calling in highly public licentiousness. But his thought at this moment, which he felt as much in his stomach as in his head, was of Tilly as a young child, before the teenager from hell, before she had run off to join the Hollywood circus. And that was odd, because thoughts of little Tilly were generally good and happy, immune from the corruption of adolescence. His little girl, his princess, his sweet pea with the giggly laugh. This was the Tilly of "Read me a story, Daddy," and "I love you extra specially, Daddy," and "Can I have a fish, please? Can I have a fish, please, Daddy, please?" Those were good thoughts. Little Tilly was a labyrinth of memory that he had stored away, preserved against the corrosion of time and circumstance. And yet now, suddenly, without reason, even the thought of little Tilly trod through his brain, dragging an old disquiet and agitation that he could not explain, like she was dragging an oversized stuffed rabbit that she had pulled out of a dumpster or sewage pit and was slinging around by the ears. Hollis shook his head sharply, more of an involuntary twitch or tremor, and the thought was gone. Momentarily, his blissful flush returned and he continued to read the shelves, making mental notes of the various projects he remembered and now wanted to complete. The photo albums. The dark room. He should reassemble the dark room. The guitar. He really should get back into the guitar, and the brewing kit. Now that he was retired, he would have time for these things. Spare time had always been the problem before, when he was working and raising children. Never enough time. A yellow wooden stepladder was leaning against the wall just inside the door. This is not where it belonged. He realized that Susan must have needed it to reach the supply of washer soap in the top of the laundry room cabinet. That explained the open door. Satisfied, he mashed his handful of underwear against the light switch until the room collapsed into darkness around the red blinking light on the tank of the boiler. He closed the door, resealing the past from the present. Upstairs, Hollis took an impulsive detour through the living room, pulled in by the still darkness pressing in against the windows, strangely reluctant to go to bed. He sat on the couch and tipped the black polycrystal mushroom to his lips, hoping the wine had miraculously regenerated. But there was still nothing. He leaned back and closed his eyes again, gripping his undergarments and listening to the faint sound of breathing from the back bedrooms. First Susan, then Ben. Susan. Ben. Susan. Ben. His mind wobbled and spun as the house around him swelled and deflated. It had been another remarkably pleasant day. Up early, meditation for a full 30 minutes. Out the door and on the road, this time before Susan was even out of the shower. He made record time to the Westin. The car felt lighter, faster, and the tires felt wider and fatter. He knew this was silly, but still. Bethany had been back out on the rock wall waiting for him, her body reclined, her legs outstretched, her face tilted upward, collecting the sun in her flawless features. Having replayed that moment at least a dozen times in the past 12 hours, Hollis was no longer the least bit hesitant to admit that the very sight of her had made his heart race. Hollis opened his eyes, jolted for an instant back into the present. He looked around the living room at his reflection in the empty black lens of the television, and then, like a leaf finding the lawn, resettled back into reverie. They had taken a booth in the back of another truck stop Waffle House and had eaten more food than he would have guessed possible only 3 days earlier. They had spoken at length of Buddhism and of Hollis's prodigious respect for Akihito Takada. She was full of questions, full of fresh interest in his life and his sense of the world. But it was not their conversation that now stood out in his mind, so much as the enduring quality of Bethany's physical presence. Everything about her was so vital, so immediate. She had left an impression, a mark, that was every bit as physical as if her likeness had been embossed on the face of a penny, and then pressed firmly into the skin of his forehead for hours at a time. Their booth at the waffle joint was unnaturally small, and in the course of reaching for syrup and butter and salt, and in the process of shifting and settling and slipping in and out to use the restroom, their limbs, both above and beneath the table, collided repeatedly. For much of their 2-hour breakfast, the top of Bethany's perfect foot came to rest firmly against the inside of his calf. All innocent, he was quite sure, and something of which Bethany was probably not at all conscious. But he could not let it go. The sensation of her foot, and the feeling that he was once again 16. They had visited 2 colleges in a single day this time. First, Ohio Wesleyan, and then up to Northwestern. Well, the University of Northwestern Ohio, in Lima. Hollis knew that he should have been embarrassed about Ohio Wesleyan. It had been his idea to go. He was the tour guide. He had insisted for 3 days that she had to visit Ohio Wesleyan. And in fact, he had been embarrassed at first. He had felt hot tendrils of shame racing up his neck and into his face as the admissions clerk, a sparsely but conspicuously whiskered, limp dish rag of a boy, assembling campus information packets by pounding sharply on a stapler, had looked at him and said, "Business school? Oh, no, this is an undergraduate institution, with an uncalled-for emphasis. We've never had a business school. And then adding, so unnecessarily, ever. And then again, as Hollis had slowly closed his eyes, and we've been around since 1842. More embarrassing still should have been the fact that, on the ride up, Hollis had regaled Bethany with suspiciously entertaining stories of people he knew. One in banking, one in advertising, and another in information technology. Smart, successful people who had come from the Ohio Wesleyan School of Business. Or so he had remembered. Real winners, he had called them. Maybe you're thinking of Wesleyan University in Connecticut, the whiskered dishrag had said as they were leaving, Hollis in front, Bethany a step behind, pushing their way through the glass double doors of the Ohio Wesleyan admissions office, out into the early sun of late summer. For a millisecond, the humiliation coalescing in his veins had paused, considering whether outrage was a more appropriate, certainly a more comfortable, emotional direction. Hollis half considered spinning on his heels, charging back into the office, and suturing the word Wesleyan across the man's face with the stapler that had noisily resumed wasting its true potential on sheaves of paper. But the humiliation, along with any nascent, ill-formed anger, dissipated. Bethany had brushed past him into the parking lot and was pointing to a plush, sunlit quadrangle of fat-bladed grass stretching out beneath a grove of trees. The trees were beginning to turn, and the suggestion of gold suspended between the blueness of sky and the greenness of earth had been enough to pull her forward, slipping out of her shoes as she went. "Hollis, I have to walk on this grass. I just have to. Come on." She had looked over her shoulder at him, extending her hand backward, dangling one shoe and then two shoes on her finger. Her face held the youthful, beatific perfection that he had by then come to expect, and yet could never quite seem to accept as real. He stared and followed, all trace of self-conscious emotion and thought of metal sutures reduced to cobwebs, like an old, bad dream. He had resisted her entreaties to shed his shoes and socks, but that was all he could resist. She reached for his hand, and he gave it to her. And it was so easy, so uncomplicated, so pure. It was such a natural complement to cool morning grass stretched beneath that blueness and that suggestion of gold and those perfect pink feet. "Hollis," she said to him when they had reached the end of the lawn and had turned back in the direction of the car.
"Hmm?"
"Thank you. I really can't take credit for the grass. She laughed delightedly. "No, thank you for sharing your time. Thank you for sharing yourself. You're such an amazing person, Hollis. You're so, I don't know, so wise and generous. I just feel really fortunate that I met you. I just want you to know that I really appreciate this." Thinking back on the day, which had slowly simmered in wine and the lateness of evening, from a million brilliant details down into a warm, pleasing paste of memory, Hollis could not now recall precisely what he had said to her in return. Only that she had squeezed his hand for emphasis, and that he had returned the gesture. The moment had an unmistakable redolence. Part floral, part sunlight on bare skin, and part forgotten youth. She was so unabashedly affectionate, so unreservedly optimistic. Every word was genuine. Every look was sincerity itself. She was so willing, so eager to learn, so interested in what he could teach her, so intelligent, and yet disarmingly naive. He remembered also that she had told him, either then or later, that Susan, Bethany referred to his wife as though they were old friends, was a very lucky woman. Had he been a man prone to guilt feelings, or if he had been doing anything inappropriate, which he had certainly not been, since there is absolutely nothing inappropriate in holding hands with a friend, and that's what she was, a friend. Hollis might have felt a slightly disconcerting twinge or a tiny bioelectric pulse of energy at the invocation of his wife. As it was, Susan's name slipped in and out of the conversation as an effortless testament to the purity of their intentions. But Bethany's observation could not help but confirm for Hollis what he had always known. Susan was lucky to have him. He was a good husband. He had done well in raising their children. He had worked hard to provide the roof and the food and the education and the entertainment. She was lucky to have a man of wisdom and patience. She sure could have done a lot worse for herself. Tonight, in fact, had been a perfect example of Susan's fortune in mating. Upon returning home after redepositing Bethany at her hotel, he had encountered Susan just inside the front door, arms full of dirty clothing and towels, with a withering look on her face. It was instantly obvious to him that she had been seething all day over his unapproved absence, and that she had been angrily rehearsing his return home. "Hollis," she had said, in that way of hers, the way that sounds as if each syllable is being separately sculpted by muscles in the back of her jaws. "Hello, dearest. Where have you been all day?" She did not let him answer. "You know, I don't care where you go or what you do, but you at least owe me the courtesy of some mention of your whereabouts. If there had been an emergency, if something had happened to Ben, I would have had no idea where to find you. You left your cell phone on the dresser, so I could not have called you if I wanted to. I think that's disrespectful."
And it had gone on from there. All her, nothing from him, until Ben had bounded into the foyer, dancing to something he heard within his disconnected headphones. Hollis had received and returned the lavishing of hugs and kisses from his son, and then had turned to his wife, waiting to resume her rebuke. "I'm very sorry, sweetheart," he had said, before she could draw another breath. "I was out early and I didn't want to wake you, and then I forgot my phone." Then he had hugged her, dirty laundry and all, unwilling to take issue with her attitude or her disingenuous concern about undefined emergencies. He was wiser than that, more patient and forbearing than that. Susan was a luckier woman than that. He had felt her muscles tense and her body stiffen, but he did not relent. In a few moments, he felt her soften, grudgingly at first, and then giving in, allowing him to squeeze the stale, angry air from her lungs. Ben had then engulfed them both with his own bouncy embrace, and they all, even Susan, who was still clutching her ball of towels and clothes, had laughed. She had offered a less than convincing excuse for not having dinner ready, and Hollis had wisely let it go, knowing that dinner had not been ready because all day Susan had been relishing the idea of punishing him with starvation. "Let's all go out to eat," he had said. "Really?" She had been unable to cover her surprise. "Sure. What do you say, my boy? How does going out to dinner tonight sound?" Susan had headed down to the laundry room with an entirely new frame of mind. And why was that? Because he was just that patient, and just that wise, and just that above all of the unnecessary unpleasantness of Susan's disposition when she lost perspective. A lesser man would have rolled up his sleeves and defended his actions and his right to go and do as he pleased in the world, and the night would have been a supremely unpleasant and unproductive affair. But Susan was a lucky woman. Dinner, for the most part, had been very enjoyable. They had gone to the Safari Hut in Columbus for steaks and potatoes and the giant all-you-can-eat salad bar. It was easily Ben's favorite restaurant, due less to the food than the life-sized animal sculptures guarding the clusters of thick wooden tables, corralled by imitation split-rail fences. "Table or booth?" the hostess had chirped. She was wearing a Safari Ranger uniform with patches on the sleeves and a hat much too big for her head. "How about a booth back there, by the giraffe?" Susan had suggested, pointing to the large leather booths along the back wall. But Hollis, acting on a contrarian impulse he did not really understand, had elbowed Ben and pointed away from the spacious booths and in the direction of a group of tables by the front windows. A giraffe? No, that won't do. What do you think of that one, Benny? Ben had followed Hollis's finger, and upon finding the sculpture, gave a bounce and a clap of approval. Ben had tried, imitatively, to bare his teeth and curl his claws and hunch his shoulders in a feral savagery he did not possess. He growled in mock ferocity, and Hollis had growled back, and then clawed at Susan's arm, beseechingly. Then, delighted, Ben had clawed at her too. Susan had laughed, shaking her head. "I guess we'll take the table by the lion." But if Hollis had, for whatever reason, denied Susan the booth by the giraffe, he had allowed her to control the dinner conversation, which, amid responding to Ben's relatively constant observations and allowing for some minor angst devoted to the state of David's relationship with May and whether David was happy in his job and whether he thought David used recreational drugs, had consisted of variations on the theme of Tilly's party. Hollis had not objected. He had not rolled his eyes. He had not ventured to pass judgment on either the party or his daughter. For better or worse, the party was important to Susan. And if indulging that particular obsession would improve her day, then he would indulge her. Susan, as Bethany Cohen had noted, was lucky to have him. "I thought I would bring Bethany Cohen to the party," had been the comment, even so nonchalantly delivered, that had threatened to take the entire evening south. "What?" "She's from out of town and doesn't know anybody. It would just be nice."
"Who is Bethany Cohen?"
"The person I've been helping."
"Helping how?"
"She's the daughter of Akihito Takada."
"Helping how?"
"He's the one I stayed with when I went..."
"Helping how, Hollis? Helping how? What made you think to invite her at the last minute without even asking? I mean, honestly, Hollis, who do you think pulls all this together? It doesn't happen by itself, I can tell you that."
"Which question would you like me to answer, Susan?"
"Well, for starters, there has to be enough food. Did you think of that? Unless you tell me that she doesn't eat, you have to serve..." "What? What's so funny?"
"Nothing. She knows how to eat. She can really pack..." "Oh, excuse me, ma'am. Can I get another glass of Pinot? Thanks."
"Hollis, don't do that. Please don't."
"Don't what, Susan?"
"That's number 3.
"Relax, Susan."
"Yeah, fine, Hollis. I'll relax. It's always on me to relax. No, Ben, here, let me get that. There you go, sweetie. I just wish you had told me sooner, Hollis."
"I didn't know sooner."
"It's very nice of you to help her do whatever it is you're helping."
"She's looking at business schools."
"It's just not as easy as saying, come on by for dinner. Is she a fan of Tilly's?"
"I don't know."
"You don't know?"
"No, Susan, I don't know."
"She does know who Tilly is, right? I mean..."
"I don't know."
"Well, Hollis, why, how... Is she just looking for some food or something? Is she some starving refugee looking for a buffet? This is a party for our daughter. It's important. We can't just have strangers in who don't give a damn. I don't want that."
"She's not a stranger."
"No? How long have you known her?"
"Oh, a few days."
"And you think that's knowing someone?"
Hollis had signaled the passing server. "We can take the check anytime."
"Hollis?"
"Hmm?"
"You think that because you've known this person for a few days that she is not a stranger to the family?"
"Mm-hmm."
"How? I don't know her. Tilly and David don't know her. None of our other guests know her. This party only works if everyone gets along and fits together, socially. Are you sure she will fit in?"
"Mm-hmm."
"Really? Are you sure she'll get along with Jude and Mickey?"
"Mm-hmm."
"Really? She's going to get along with Peaches?"
"Mm-hmm."
"And Rhonda Davenport? You know, Rhonda can be quite something." Are you sure this, what's her name, Hollis?
Hmm?
Your friend. What's her name?
What friend?
Hollis, the one you invited to Tilly's party, the one we are talking about.
Bethany Cohen.
Are you sure Bethany Cohen will even enjoy the likes of Rhonda Davenport?
Mm-hmm. How do you like that mac and cheese there, partner?
How, Hollis?
Hmm?
How can you be sure she'll fit in?
She'll be fine.
Yes, but I'm asking why you think so.
She'll be fine.
Hollis!
Hmm? And so it had gone, through dinner, a fourth glass of Pinot Noir, dessert, and all the way home. But while the conversation and rapport had not maintained the rosy feel that had immediately preceded the safari hut, it also did not devolve into outright argument. And this, Hollis knew, even if Susan could not appreciate it, was entirely due to his ability to rise above her petty concerns. He was smarter than to take the bait, and this was as much to her benefit as to his own. Not that he wouldn't have loved to teach Susan a thing or two about herself, to show her the illogic, the incredible shallowness of her social concerns, to lay bare for her own inspection her rampant insecurity, her misdirected anxiety, and her penchant for projection. Quite the contrary, he had itched to share a candid observation or two. Hadn't Susan, in fact, invited her own friend Gail to the party? Did she think he had forgotten this? Did Gail know the family? Was Gail a fan of Tilly's? Not that he cared in the least. The point was that Susan was lacking perspective. Her thinking was muddled. And he could have laid it all out for her. But he knew she would never take the lesson. She would have rejected his insights wholesale as mean-spirited criticism. She would have started demanding apologies and counseling, and the conversation would have seized the evening in its jaws and plowed through the floor of the safari hut directly into the earth beneath the city of Columbus. And it would have been Susan, not him, who would have suffered the most. It would have been she, not he, who would have gone to bed crying. But Susan had not gone to bed crying, and whether she understood it or not, her dry eyes and her already overtaxed mucous membranes had only his emotional restraint to thank. Wisdom is its own reward. Its value does not depend on its apprehension by others. Indeed, true wisdom, marked by its inaccessibility, is a solitary pursuit. That tends to make those who are less contemplative, those who are less in tune with themselves, angry and frustrated, and of a mind to cast blame and feel personally rejected. He had been wise enough to spare her that turmoil. He had checked out of the conversation at the point where wisdom intersected with mercy. It was, in fact, as simple as it had been put to him earlier in the day. Susan was a lucky woman. Of course, while lucky Susan had not gone to bed crying, she had gone to bed thoroughly pissed off. Upon returning from dinner, Hollis had spent some time with Ben, and when Susan had gone up to take a shower, he had quietly repaired himself to his study with a glass of Chablis. There he had listened to Bach, and contemplated his bonsai, and meditated so comfortably that the unknowing might have thought him asleep. He opened his eyes and slowly regarded the dark living room. His muscles were relaxed and the blood felt warm in his veins. The quiet stillness of the house packed in around his ears so densely that he could hear his own heartbeat. His hands lay in his lap, still clutching his bouquet of clean underwear and his empty wine glass. Hollis leaned forward and emptied his hands onto the low square coffee table in front of him. As he leaned back into the inviting cloud of the sofa, his hand, as if of its own volition, snagged the remote control. He muted the sound as the dark box against the far wall came to life. The screen exploded across the living room in a ball of silent blue light, like a miniature supernova. A man, the head of a man, was talking at him. insistently, urgently, pointing at him, and yet at the same time with shoulder shrugs and lifted eyebrows and dismissive hand gestures that seemed to say, all of this is so simple, so axiomatic, that I am wasting my time even talking about it. Hollis pushed a button and gave him the power of speech.
You know what they're going to say, because they've said it all before, and believe me, these people are nothing if not predictable.
What I'm going to hear all day long for the next week is Mike O'Donnell is a cold-hearted, unsympathetic, uncaring individual.
Okay? That's what I'm going to hear all day long from the New York Times and, God help us all, the mainstream liberal media, okay? They'll all say it because they're all out to get me, but you know what? I don't care. I just don't.
Hollis suddenly felt the gnaw of hunger and rolled forward off the front of the sofa far enough so that he could stand. He clicked the volume up a notch and padded off to the kitchen for a snack. In less than a minute, he was back, collapsing back down into the sofa. Literally an uncontrolled fall this time, using two fingers to fish an Oreo cookie out of the bag. He crunched slowly, enjoying the sensory experience of snapping and then crushing the dark chocolate wafers and the squish of white paste.
And the third group of people that are not going to make it in this country are the mentally ill, okay? The mentally ill, and that's it. Anybody else can make a ton of money. A ton. And it's not about your race or your religion or your ethnicity or how poor your parents were. None of that's holding you back, okay? Okay, Senator? Look at me. I'm a perfect example. I grew up dirt poor. I didn't particularly...
Hollis changed to the History Channel, silencing the man that for 2 days in a row, Bethany Cohen had so wanted to hear on his radio, today searching up and down the dial as they glided back toward Columbus from Ohio Wesleyan, asking him incredulously how it could be possible that he had never listened to Mike O'Donnell's radio fixture. Hollis, at least from this small sampling, did not entirely grasp the appeal. But then Hollis had never really grasped the cult of personality that seemed to so enthrall the younger generations. Such a poor substitute for actual wisdom and understanding. It inhibited the refinement of thought and perception. It dulled the senses. He fished another Oreo out of the bag and popped it into his mouth, crunching with slow and deliberate abandon. He changed the channel, trading a documentary on the life of Helen Keller for a woman demonstrating the miracle of carpet stain remover. Yes, this O'Donnell character was beneath Bethany. Not necessarily in and of himself. Hollis did not actually know anything about the man personally, but more because he was obviously iconic of a generally base and destructive popular culture. Hollis understood in his bones what Bethany perhaps had yet to learn. That to follow popular culture, to turn to it in times of crisis, to consult it for information, to lean upon it for support, to hide behind it, to depend on it, like Tilly, or like Susan, would, in time, reduce a person to a soulless automaton, following rather than leading, responding only to baser instincts, incapable of attaining a higher consciousness, congealing with the rest of the masses into an undifferentiated blob of disgusting impulse. With a twitch of his thumb, Hollis left the woman who was extracting spaghetti sauce from a cream-colored carpet. He sped past 8 or 9 channels until he found what he knew was waiting. 2 women, enjoying poolside sunshine, the legs of one wrapped firmly around the head of the other, a short-haired blonde whose arms blindly, frantically groped for the bouncing flesh buoys of her dark-haired companion, like she was drowning in pleasure. Hollis popped 2 Oreos in his mouth at once. In 20 minutes, cradled in the arms of his day, warmed by his own compassion for the poor, hapless souls living unexamined lives, and sprinkled in dark crumbs, he drifted off to sleep.